This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Huckberry. You never know what sort of cool gear and clothing you're going to find over at Huckberry because every week it changes from camping gear to office equipment to everyday carry items to workout clothes. They've got you covered over there at Huckberry. You can see my favorite items at Huckberry at aom.is/aomhuck. And if you'd like to get free shipping on your first order, go to huckberry.com and use promo code AOM free ship at checkout for free shipping on your first order. Available only to U.S. customers. Sorry, international folks. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So during World War II, the mountain island of Crete off the coast of Greece was occupied by the Nazis. And it was actually a strategic point during the war. And there was this small group of resistance fighters that consisted of Brits as well as native Cretans that came with this audacious plan to abduct a German general and take them off the island. And here's the thing, these resistance fighters, they weren't like SEAL commando types or paratroopers. One was a penniless artist, another was a young shepherd, and another was a playboy poet. Yet somehow they're able to pull off this amazing feat of strength and endurance and wits. And my guest today wanted to figure out, how did these guys do it? His name is Christopher McDougall, and his book that he retraces the steps of these resistance fighters is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. And in it, he follows the steps of these resistance fighters and along the way finds out and it discovers this ancient art of heroism that the Greeks developed thousands of years ago that consisted of skills, but as well as virtues that a hero should develop and that they taught one another. Really fascinating. If you love Greek history, you're going to love this podcast. We talk about pankration, which is this brutal form of martial arts that the Greeks developed. We talk about endurance running and fascia and the power of fascia. We talk about intuitive aiming and shooting. We talk about the skills and the virtues the Greeks developed, like arete and paideia and xenia, and we'll discuss what those all mean. And then how we today, even below average Joe Blows, can develop this lost art of heroism as well in our own lives. Really fun podcast. I think you're going to enjoy it. And be sure to check out the show notes after you're done listening for links to resources and things we mentioned in the podcast so you can delve deeper into the topic. You can find that at AOM. You can find those show notes at aom.is/heroes. And as always, if you enjoy the podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. All right, Chris McDougall, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here, Brett.
So your book is, your latest book is Natural Born Heroes, Mastering the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. It's now available on paperback. And this, I love this book because it's just jam-packed. It's got a great story, but then it's jam-packed with all these rabbit holes of interest into ancient Greek culture, which I love. So it's about these secrets of strength and endurance that the Greeks understood and taught. And you try to find out about these things and how we can recover them today. But you start the book off talking about this group of resistance fighters on the island of Crete during World War II that consisted of natives, but as well as this ragtag group from, I didn't know this organization existed. It was the British Special Operations Executive.
Right.
Can you tell our listeners the backstory of what this, you know, who these people were, why they were unique, and how they managed to kidnap a Nazi general?
You know, it's fascinating, and I think it's what makes your site so important, is it's remarkable how short-sighted humanity is, how short-sighted we are as a species, because if anything predates like 15 years ago, it's as if it never happened. And, you know, we keep rediscovering stuff like, oh my God, like kettlebells, you know, Indian clubs, like what an amazing invention. Like, dude, these have been around forever. And yet we just keep forgetting about them. And that's what I think initially led me to this whole saga, because I stumbled across this story about a Cretan shepherd who became a foot messenger during World War II. And as I'm reading about his adventures, I suddenly like hit the brakes and said, wait a second. There's no way. There's no way anybody runs 50 miles through mountainous terrain on a starvation diet, delivers a message, has a shot of moonshine, and then turns around and runs back another 50 miles. Forget it. It's 100 miles of ultra endurance athletics off trail with no caloric intake. It's physically impossible. So I began researching that, like, you know, physiologically, how can you pull off something like that? And what it led me across, again, was this whole bizarre adventure story that is a drama in its own right. But to me, what was much more interesting was unpacking all the fitness and health and, I guess, social psychology secrets that are new to us, but basically everyday life for every indigenous culture on the planet that has not been exposed to modern technology.
Gotcha. So this adventure story you talk about is amazing, and you weave it throughout your book, and then you take – you know, there's stopping points where you go on these segues about exploring the physiology, the nutrition, you know, what made it possible that these guys were able to do this. So let's start there. I mean, the main premise of this book is these resistance fighters were harnessing this idea of heroism that existed since the times of ancient Greece, since Odysseus, Achilles, Plato, Aristotle. So can you tell us, how did the ancient Greeks define heroism, and how is it different from how we think of heroism today?
Sure. Well, again, this was a perfect learning laboratory because, you know, one thing about World War II was you don't get any more higher stakes than that. There is no thinner margin of error than fighting the most deadly killing force in human history, you know, opposing the Nazi regime. So, well, again, one thing which was important for me at the beginning was realizing that the group you mentioned, the Special Operations Executive, this kind of stuff was brand new because prior to World War II, warfare was conventional. You know, you had your army, I had mine. I dug my trenches, you dug your trenches. And we sat there and we shot each other until we were all dead. Well, then Churchill, who was a veteran of the colonial wars, and he'd been getting his ass handed to him by Boer fighters, by, you know, Punjabis, by the IRA. He'd had him personally, and also the forces under his command, had constantly been sniped at by guerrilla forces, you know, in disguise in the colonies. So at World War II, he created innovation. He's like, you know what? Why don't we just fight undercover? But again, you didn't want to take your best soldiers and put them undercover behind enemy lines because you actually needed those guys to man the artillery. So they took basically the has-beens, the misfits, the, you know, the 45-year-old history professors and the 37-year-old librarians, the guys who spoke a little bit of a foreign language, they stuck those guys behind enemy lines. So for me, this became the perfect learning laboratory. If you take somebody who is not fit to be a hero, can that person undergo some kind of process where they go from sort of zero to hero in as limited time as possible and under the greatest possible stress? And that's basically led me back to the ancient Greek art of the hero, which, again, unfortunately, I didn't really realize existed. I'm a product of my culture, so I believed a hero was the guy with the six-pack abs and the double guns kicking down the door. You know, it was the strongest, toughest guy in the room. I didn't realize that. And again, it should have been obvious, but why let heroism be a product of chance? Why not make it a statistical probability by teaching everybody the fine art of how to be a hero? And that's essentially what these misfit soldiers underwent when they went to Crete. They basically learned the ancient Greek art of the hero. So your question was, what is it? You know, essentially, it comes down to three things. You take the lowest common denominators of your culture and things that everybody shares, and you find ways to burnish those common skills so that they're practical in a crisis. And for the Greeks, that relied on three things, all three of which were indispensable: strength, skill, and compassion. And when you look at those three things, they've been ritualized in every major culture and religion throughout history. You know, they are mind, body, and soul. They are all the tenets of major religion have to do with the fact that you have to be physically capable, you have to have intellectual skills, and you have to have a connection to your fellow humans. So that's basically what it is: strength, skill, and compassion. if you have any two overwhelming the third, then the stool topples over. So all three of those things have got to be harnessed and polished and perfected.
Gotcha. So strength was arete, right, in Greek?
Exactly.
Skill is paideia?
Paideia, exactly.
And then compassion, or another way it translates is hospitality, xenia.
Yeah, exactly.
Xenia. Yeah. And I guess the Greeks looked to their heroes, like from the great myths, that each, you know, they had heroes that embodied each of these traits. So, I mean, I guess Achilles would be the strength guy, the arete guy, the excellence in strength. Odysseus, the skillful guy, the wily guy. I don't know who would – I guess all of them exhibited xenia to some extent.
Even Hercules, all of them for sure. But, you know, it's funny. So is it Gregory Nagy or Nagel? Nagy, right? The Harvard professor who specializes in Greek mythology and heroes. He wrote an entire book about Odysseus called The Best of the Achaeans. And I believe Homer would identify Odysseus as the best of the Achaeans. You know, he is the hero of heroes. But you look at Odysseus, he's the guy that's always trying to like get out of combat, doesn't want to fight, always pulling some fast one on somebody. And in some ways, he's kind of the biggest scumbag of the Greek pantheon. But from the Greek perspective, he is the hero of heroes because he's connected to his people. I mean, he is fighting his way back home to get to his wife and son no matter what. He is tied in with his people. And the people who come to him to fight with him are his servants, you know, the people who are underneath him. They love him because he loves them. He uses his brain first and his muscle second, but both of them are pretty formidable. Like, you don't want to with Odysseus. But anyway, you know, Odysseus is a guy that you push him, man, he will destroy you, but he'll try and scheme his way out of trouble first. When you look at all of the Greek heroes and demigods, we tend to think of them as loners, but without exception, every single one of them has some very tight sibling bond or filial bond with somebody else. With Achilles, it was Patroclus, you know, he loved him like a brother and would not go into battle, you know, without Patroclus by his side. Hercules had his close friends and a half-brother that he was completely devoted to. So the idea is that you have to be tightly knit to your group or you're kind of useless.
Right. And that going back to that being useless, I mean, you talk about this in the book for the Greeks and for other indigenous cultures, ancient cultures, you know, the defining mark of manhood or adulthood was you had to be able to rescue someone. You had to be able to help people. That was what made you an adult in that culture. But somehow we've lost that concept today.
Yeah, it's you're right. And again, I'm sort of struck with remorse because I feel like I am the symptom that I'm talking about. I feel like I was raised that way. The idea is, you know, unfortunately, we are creatures that are perfectly evolved to deal beautifully in an emergency. The human animal is fantastic at adapting and all kinds of quick physical responses. Yet we also have a brain which tries to conserve energy at all costs. And so what we've done is we've outsourced all of our emergency crisis control to other people. And so, you know, right now, you know, if someone steals my car, I don't chase the guy. I call the cops. If my house is on fire, I don't get a hose. I call the fire department. If I want food, I pick up my phone and have someone bring me food. You know, again, the most basic elemental need in human life to sustain yourself with food, we have other people do it for us. So that, unfortunately, is a situation we've gotten ourselves into, which is that we don't realize anymore that we are responsible, not just for ourselves, but for others. And to be responsible for others means that you have to know stuff. You know, you have to be ready to pick up a child. And, you know, it sounds easy, but if you ever actually try to pick up a kid, you know, a 10-year-old kid, they're kind of hard to pick up. You know, like, they're not properly balanced. They don't come with the right handles. And, you know, most of us have gotten away from a sense of fitness as being something useful, and we've turned it into something that's just purely self-glamorizing.
Right. Yeah. You want the sculpt the perfect body. That's what it's about now.
Yeah.
So these British resistance fighters, they were steeped in this culture of heroism that still existed on the island of Crete at the time, even though this was thousands of years after the heyday of the ancient Greeks. And so along the way, they picked up these skills, this idea of physical fitness, this idea of compassion. So let's kind of get into the physiology that you explore in this book. So you talk about that runner who was able to run across these rugged Cretan mountains, 50 miles, starvation diet, but still managed to do it, drink some moonshine, then go back. And you talk, you have a chapter in your book about the Cretan bounce is what you call it. And you use it to explore the power of our fascia. So what can we learn about the Cretan bounce, about the ability to use this power in our, you know, fascia? It's not muscle, it's not bone, it's sort of like chickens. I don't know, it's kind of weird stuff. Can you explain what fascia is and like the power that's in it?
I'm going to use your definition. It's kind of weird stuff. Let's just go with that. Yeah, so here's the deal with this. There are a couple of threads that which became braided together. One was, you know, when I heard about this bizarre operation on Crete where the resistance decided, you know what, rather than getting chased by the Germans, let's go get one of them for ourselves. And they decided to go kidnap the commanding German general on the island of Crete, which, you know, again, is just a really, really stupid idea. It's a bad idea. No one has ever tried it in modern military history. It's just way too high risk.
But it's a very Cretan thing to do, right?
Like, it's a totally Cretan thing to do, which is, yeah. And I guess that's the reason why these guys tend to pull this kind of stuff off. It's so brazen. It is so anti-intellectual. It throws the textbook away. But again, that's what was winning the war, was throwing away the textbook. And what was so cool about it, though, was – in some ways, these guys kind of overlooked an obvious problem, which is like, you're on an island, dudes. There's nowhere to go. You get this guy, like, then what? What's the next move? Which is basically you go on the run in a confined space. So again, it's a totally brazen move. And they were on the run for more than a month. So imagine that. You are in a race that goes on 24/7 for 40 days, being pursued by like attack dogs and pissed off German soldiers. So the thing about this was, again, so I want to know how they could physically pull this off. And when I would read up on battles and guerrilla warfare and colonial fights on Crete, I kept coming across these references to a unique way that the Cretans would move. And anybody could always spot a Cretan across a landscape because they move like mountain goats. These guys are bouncing as quickly uphill as they're going downhill. And I was finding this in military accounts, you know, dating back in the 1700s and 1800s. And then when I was on Crete myself, I went over there to recreate the exact footsteps of these guys who ran through the mountains. And I saw the same thing. You know, I'd be, you know, 10,000 feet up a mountain and I look above me and there's some shepherd, you know, just bouncing along like he's in one of those like kid moon bounces. So I became fascinated by how do these guys do this? And it led me to a whole new field of research into human fascia. And there's a guy named Tom Myers, an anatomist, and he really sort of revolutionized the perspective on human strength by turning his scalpel sideways. You know, ordinarily when you would dissect a cadaver, you cut through all this sort of the skin, the filmy stuff, until you get down to all like the meat and muscle below. Well, what Tom Myers realized is that anywhere you're cutting a cadaver, you're coming across this same filmy kind of like exo-webbing. So rather than cut through it, he turned his scalpel sideways and began to essentially skin bodies to see what is between the muscle and the skin. And what he found is this really fascinating kind of like web – it's like a wetsuit coating throughout our bodies of this very – strong, sort of tensile resisting rubbery substance called fascia. And what Myers realized is, you know, the fascia is like the cat gut in a tennis racket. It's the string on the bow. So you can use your muscular force to pull back the bowstring, but the real thrust comes from the string itself, comes from that rubbery tendon. So what he began to look at the human body is, instead of it being something dominated by muscle, the muscle is a minor player, which is essentially just pulling the fascia back into position. And it's the recoil and the snap of the fascia, which really provides the power and force.
So the Cretans were, with their sort of their bounce they used, were taking advantage of their fascia, which allowed them to go long distance without tiring, I guess, is what's going on.
Precisely. And, you know, I see it myself now, too. I'm kind of a poor student of my own theories because I'll learn something – I'll do it. But, you know, as fatigue sets in, lessons go out the window. So if I'm on a trail run right now, I'll be going great. I'll be bouncing over rocks. I'll be leaping over logs. But then you get tired and I start to revert back to this heavy plodding, muscular driven gait. And I'll start to wonder, man, why does my groin hurt? Like, you know, why are my legs so tired? And I'll look down and realize that I'm no longer using that Cretan bounce. And I've got to remind myself to get back to that much more bouncy stride.
Yeah, we'll get back to fascia later when we talk about MoveNat, because I'm a big fan of MoveNat and Erwan Lacour's work that he's doing. But yeah, that fascia, I mean, that's kind of what Bruce Lee used, right? With his famous, you know, punch, 1-inch punch. Like, it wasn't muscle. It was just he was using this elasticity to deliver that blow and be able to knock someone down.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, too, how we've, again, approached martial arts and fighting. You know, we've gotten this very – I mean, we look at, like, MMA as being – you know, the ultimate, like, no rules combat, but there's a ton of rules. There's a ton of stuff you can't do.
It's a sport.
In the octagon, exactly. It's a sport. Yeah, it's a sport slash performance. You don't want to repel your viewers by gouging out somebody's eyeball. So things are kept within a certain level of decorum. But in real fighting, those rules don't exist. And the idea is you want to use maximum force, minimum energy. And Bruce Lee, again, was a perfect embodiment of that. A relatively small guy who learned how to use what he called the 1-inch punch. He would say that his punch with his right fist began with his left toe, and everything would torque and twist and unload like a slingshot.
Right, using his body like a bow.
Yeah.
So let's go. You know, going on to this fighting thing. Let's continue this fighting theme. You talk about this fellow named Rex Applegate.
Yeah.
World War II. He taught. He wrote the manual for hand-to-hand combat for, I guess, the Marines. I guess is how it was during World War II, and he had this intuitive understanding of the best way to fight with weapons and hand-in-hand. That you argue is what the Greeks understood as well. So he tells about a little bit about Rex Applegate and the way he approached fighting both with weapons and with your hands.
This is one of, like, the fascinating stories that I came across completely by accident, and I think it worked backwards. I was looking to the special operations executive. So here you got Churchill. He wants to create this whole new undercover special forces thing, but it's never existed before. And so he had to find some trainers. And what he did was he brought back these guys, Fairbairn and Sykes, these basically cops who were serving in Shanghai, British cops serving in Shanghai. And Shanghai was just like the gutter, man. It was like the dirtiest, toughest part of town of the world. It was like the world's like fighting capital. So he brings these two guys back to teach real street combat to his newly recruited misfits. And they were unbelievably effective. They were just transforming these guys because they were basically teaching them how to fight in a real gutter situation. Now, Rex Applegate was over in the U.S. at the same time, and he was going through basic training, and he's being taught how to fire a weapon in the U.S. Army style. But his uncle was a champion trick shooter, you know, the kind of guy from like the old Wild West shows like Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley, you know, where you throw a bunch of dishes in the air, and this guy's firing from the hip, and he's blasting these things out of the air. So Rex Applegate is listening to his drill instructors teach him how to shoot. He's like, yeah, that's not the way Uncle Bob shot. Uncle Bob shot from the hip, and he's way more effective than these guys. So Applegate got a commission to start studying the old trick shooters to find out what they knew. And one of the guys he went to research was Wild Bill Hickok. And he went back to like the last known address of Wild Bill Hickok, which is some like saloon out somewhere in like Idaho. And he found a letter that Hickok had written but hadn't been mailed, where he's describing his shooting technique. And basically what Wild Bill Hickok said is, it's the same as pointing a finger. Like, your finger knows where the target is. You don't have to tell your finger. So like right now, Brett, if someone startled you and you turn around really quickly, your hand would know exactly where to go. You don't have to order your hand. Your hand is going to fly in the direction of the threat. So Applegate realizes there's something here about this idea of instinctive aim. So he hears about these guys, Fairbairn and Sykes, in the UK. So he flies over, ships over to see them. And not only are they teaching him shooting, they're also teaching him this street gutter style of fighting. And essentially, it comes down to two things. One is you go for the vulnerable spots immediately,
But secondly, you use a lot of body torque and twist to use the minimum amount of muscular force to disable your enemy.
Right. So you're not going for style points with the awesome uppercut. You are just going for the jugular right away.
Yeah, I mean, one of Fairbairn's favorite moves is what he called like the Bronco Stomp, which was that once you get your guy on the ground, you then jump up and down on his rib cage as hard as you can. You try and pull. I mean, exactly. You would get flagged pretty quick for that.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, guys, Mother's Day is May 8th. I know it sneaks up on you every single year, but look, you still got enough time to order mom the best flowers of her life from Books.com. Books flowers are, in a word, gorgeous. So here's the thing with Books. You might have seen these guys on Shark Tank. They grow their flowers on an eco-friendly farm on the side of a freaking volcano. And because they have this vitamin-rich, nutrient-rich soil from a volcano, the flowers bloom larger and the colors are more vibrant. I got my wife some Books flowers 2 weeks ago, and we're still enjoying them. And also, one of the things I like about Books is they cut the flowers fresh when you order them, so that's why they last so long. One of the reasons why they last so long. Another thing I like about Books, they make ordering super simple, and the prices are affordable. Flowers start at just $40, and there's no hidden fees. They're not going to try to upsell you with a stuffed teddy bear or a balloon, just flowers. And the shipping is absolutely free when you register with Books. So listen up. If you want to get your mom, really impress her, your wife who happens to be a mom, some flowers for Mother's Day, got a discount for you, go to Books.com. And that's spelled Bouqs.com. And enter promo code manliness for 20% off the bouquet of your choice. Again, Books.com, promo code manliness for 20% off the bouquet of your choice. Also by Mott and Bow. So these guys make high quality denim at affordable price. What I love about them is their simple design. There's no weird stitching or anything that you see on some other jeans. It's just plain sharp looking denim that you could wear with a t-shirt and pair of sneaks, or to the office with a button down shirt and a sport coat and you look sharp. If you're an athletic guy and have large thighs like I do, and you've had trouble finding jeans that feel comfortable around your thighs, check out the Mercer. It has an amazing 20% stretch component to it. These things are really ridiculously comfortable. I could do barbell squats in them and without a problem at all. So I highly recommend to check that out. And if you want to try Mott & Bow out, I got an offer for you. Go to mottandbow.com. That's MOTTANDBOW.com and use promo code ARTOFMAN for 20% off your first purchase. And also take advantage of their home try-on program. If you're not sure about your waist size, order one waist size and then put in another one that, you know, either above or below. They'll send you both for free. Try them both on, keep the one that fits, and send the other one back completely for free.
And then
how is
this
what he taught?
Again,
what these
that's mottandbow.com,
similar
promo
to the
code
Greek art
of check out for 20% off.
But now back to the show.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
As far as I know. Here's the deal. So, you know, recently it's become Wing Chun has come into vogue, not least because Robert Downey Jr. has become a, you know, devotee of Wing Chun. And if you saw him in the Sherlock Holmes movie where he's in that bare knuckles match, he uses some beautiful Wing Chun moves to disable this like gigantic brute. So, you know, Wing Chun is a very elegant, and Bruce Lee also was a student of Wing Chun. It's a very elegant, almost dance-like approach to martial arts. And what's beautiful about Wing Chun is it's said to be the only martial art created by a woman. And there is a myth that there was a Chinese nun in a monastery. And when the monastery was attacked, everyone was slaughtered except her. And she escaped into the wilderness. And there, by observing the animals, she learned to fight, you know, with the grace, elegance, and speed of a jungle animal. So it's a great myth. But actually, it seems to be just that, just a myth. It's much more likely that Wing Chun and all of the Asian martial arts are derivatives of the ancient Greek art of Pankration. And Pankration was originated on the Greek island. This is where all the conspiracy theories come together. So the whole myth of the Minotaur, right, of jumping the bulls and getting yourself out of the labyrinth, that actually happened in the kingdom of Minos on Crete, which really was the birthplace of all Greek culture. Was on the island of Crete. Pankration began, perfected on Crete. It was then brought to Alexander the Great, who trained his troops in Pancrasian and then brought it into Asia as he began his eastward expansion. And so essentially, this one island nation created the basis of the martial arts, which then flowered throughout Asia and then came back to us today.
That's crazy. So Pancrasian was the no holes bar type of fighting. Like, you weren't going for style points. You were trying to maim and kill your opponent.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. And so when you read some of the accounts of Pancrasian, which was, you know, always like in and out of the Olympics, it would be in the ancient Olympics and they would take it back out again, then they'd put it back in again, just because it was so brutal. And also not really spectator friendly, because sometimes a bout would end in like 3 seconds. So you just grab the other dude's fingers and bend his fingers back and break his fingers and he's done, you know, or you get him by the testicles and tear and he's out. So Pancrasian, they would always like take it out of the Olympics and the Spartans would scream bloody murder and like, all right, we gotta appease the Spartans. It's back in again. But again, that was the idea, was you remove the gloves, you remove the rules, and you let people fight exactly as they would if they're trying to survive in a combat situation.
That's nice. And I guess when they revived the Olympics in the modern era, there was debate. Should we put this in here? And I guess they didn't put Pancrasian in it. They decided not to.
Well, you know, the beautiful thing is, and what made these British Special Forces guys so perfect as students of the Cretan way of going about things was, you know, the Brits are raised steeped in ancient Greek culture and Roman culture. So for us, it's like, you know, it's the mandatory course you got to take your like junior year in high school or something. But the, you know, British school system was based on ancient Greek culture. And, you know, the perfect flowering of that was Lawrence of Arabia. You know, you take little old T. Lawrence and you stick him out in a hostile situation in the Mideast, and he draws back on this sense of the transformative art of the hero. So not only were British kids brought up on the myth of the ancient Greek hero, but then they actually saw it actually work when T. E. Lawrence brought it to life himself.
Right, because they were turned into warriors. I like that. I get there was Hector. If we're going back to Odysseus,
sure,
or the Iliad, some would say that Achilles was a natural born warrior, right? He just had it in him. And Hector, another great warrior, I think there's a phrase in Greek that said he had to learn how to become a warrior, and that's what actually made him probably a more superior warrior, because he had that sense of compassion, but then that headiness about it, but then he added the skill to it. And so these are what these like Greek British resistance fighters were doing. I love that. So you have you dovetail into parkour, which is this it started in France as this like underground urban guys just having fun. But how did your tracing the footsteps of these British resistance fighters lead you to jumping across rooftops in France?
Yeah, so there are a couple of guidelines I always have when I'm looking at this kind of stuff. You want to avoid two things. You want to avoid something that is basically useless in the modern world. So if it's a fitness tip, but it relies on like eating living goat hearts, like, all right, there's not a whole lot of practical takeaway for most people today. You know, we're not going to be eating any live beating goat hearts. And the second thing I try to avoid is anything that is trendy, that doesn't have a legacy and a long timeline that can be traced. So again, if it's like, you know, PX90, it might be great, but it's something that we just kind of created for ourselves, and there's no long, deep historical taproot that demonstrates that this has been effective in real life situations for a long time. So whenever I'm researching this kind of stuff, I'm looking for those two things. What's the practical takeaway? And what is the long historical lineage that proves that it actually has worked? So when I'm looking at the Cretan bounce, for instance, I'm looking at this ability to race across mountaintops. I thought, okay, but what's the takeaway? How can we learn this kind of stuff? And it immediately draws you toward parkour. And in me specifically, what made the light bulb go off was I was in the middle of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, you know, like Amish country, and I'm coming out of like a Rite Aid drugstore. And as I'm at the checkout line, out the window, I see these guys like kind of like flying through the air, just like leaping through the air, back and forth. And I read a little bit about parkour by that point, but I'd never actually seen it. And so I hustle out of the drugstore, and these guys are like doing these like long jumps, these precision jumps back and forth on the handicap railings outside the drugstore. And they said, yeah, you know, we do parkour. And, you know, if you want to come learn with us. And they said, but if you really want to learn, you want to go to London, to Parkour Generations, which is the great learning school, you know, the French masters, the Yamakaze, who first created parkour, they passed on their knowledge to these teachers in London. So I ended up going there and actually studying with a women's only class because, again, I was interested in something else too. The third thing I always sort of look for is that if something I think is really native to the human species, it's got to be native to both sides of the species. It can't just be just dudes only or women only. And one thing about parkour is it is a egalitarian sport. Women are just as good at it as guys are. So that was it. I basically apprenticed myself to the parkour teachers to see if what they were doing was a good modern approximation of what the Cretans have been doing for thousands of years.
So they're taking advantage of the fascia again.
Yeah, again, it's a fascinating thing to do. You know, when the first time I tried to do what's known as a turn vault, it's a very simple vault, and you see a parkour dude do it, it looks like nothing. And then you try to do it, and you're banging the crap out of your knees, and you're not getting off the ground. And then they just show you the way of just changing your center of balance, about lifting your butt and balancing yourself, and essentially letting your own natural balance take over. And it's really amazing how in a span of like 90 seconds, you go from feeling something is impossible to feeling something is easy and you can fly.
And so this discussion about parkour leads naturally to MoveNat. So how is MoveNat? Well, first, can you explain what MoveNat is for our listeners? We've written about MoveNat. We've had Irwan write an article or two for us on the site about it. But for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, what is MoveNat and how is what they're doing resurrecting this idea of ancient Greek physical fitness?
Well, I got a great story about MoveNat, Brett, which I think is sort of unique to anyone who's become familiar with Erwan Lacour. I first heard about Erwan because of Barefoot Ted, the guy that I wrote about a good bit in Born to Run.
Right.
So when I first came back, we were down the Copper Canyons in 2006 for that ultramarathon with the Tatahumada Indians. And when I came back, I thought, you know what, this could be a really good book. So I went around to spend time with every person who'd been down on the trip with us and re-interview them and learn more about their lives. So I went out to Burbank, where Barefoot Ted was living at the time, and hung out with him for a couple of days. And while I was with him, you know, one day he opens up his email and he's like, huh, this is interesting. He goes, hey, you know, you might want to take a look at this. And it was an email from some French guy named Erwan Lacour, who was living down in Brazil. And he had seen some posts by Barefoot Ted about minimalist running. And so Erwan had contacted Ted to just get more information. So I became pretty fascinated and I contacted Erwan myself. And a few months later, I was heading down to Brazil and he was like taking me through the Brazilian rainforest, training with him and a bunch of like UFC fighters, you know, these Brazilian jiu-jitsu dudes who were training with Erwan, literally like in the rainforest along the beach down in Brazil. So that was, I think, my first intro. I don't think it was even called MoveNat at the time. Might have been. So what Erwan was doing was modernizing the idea of the natural method, the méthode naturelle, of a guy named Georges Hébert. And, you know, Georges Hébert was a French naval officer back in the early 1900s, and he was stationed in a troop ship off the coast of the island of Martinique when the volcano exploded. And he led the rescue operation trying to get people off the island, but he was just horrified to see people die because they couldn't, like, swim a few yards offshore, or they were struggling to pick up a child, or they couldn't climb up a rope. These basic physical reactions that every other species would handle no problem, yet for some reason humans couldn't do these things. So he began to develop this thing called the natural method, which is based on the 10 natural human movements that every human should be able to master. And very basic things, you know, to run, to walk, to climb, to jump, to throw, to catch, to defend, to attack. And he created these obstacle courses in France to train first French naval officers and then everybody else in the natural method. Unfortunately, you know, after World War I, most of the natural method teachers were killed during the fighting, and the natural method essentially disappeared except for in two locations. One was with David Bell, who was the son of Raymond Bell, who was a French firefighter, and the French firefighters were still training in the natural method. And the other place was with Erwan LeCour down in his like wacky hippie ultimate fighting camp in Brazil.
Right. And what's interesting is that the natural method, I mean, there's these strands of what the ancient Greeks did, right? It was very kind of body weight, calisthenics, learning how to use your body efficiently and effectively. And he was able to pick that up. And incorporate it. And like, I guess Erwan is continuing that tradition as well.
And the sad thing too, Brad, is like when you start to examine this stuff, you just feel like, dude, why is there even any debate about this? Like, why is there even any question about the best way to exercise and get in shape? If you do one MoveNad session, to me, essentially the conversation's over. Like, that's all you need to do. And again, the best evidence is Erwan himself. You know, if you check out his video of him just racing around Corsica, like leaping into rivers and pushing logs and stuff, like that's the dude I want to be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he looks like Tarzan. I mean, yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. And my wife and I have been doing MoveNet. So is my son, and we love it. It's a lot of fun. It's like play. I mean, you're playing, but you're getting a good workout.
How old is your son?
He's five.
Do you where are you based?
Based in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
So I guess I was trying to think, there are usually parkour communities everywhere. I'm not sure.
There is a small one here in Tulsa. But yeah, we have two good MoveNad instructors here, fortunately, okay, which is great because usually Tulsa doesn't have things like that, but we do. And you know, what's interesting too, the MoveNad thing and talking about this natural method. I had two guys on my podcast a few months ago or about a month ago. They did a documentary about La Sierra High. Have you heard about this place?
No.
You need to check this out. So there was this high school called La Sierra in California during the 1960s. They had this intense physical education program, and it was like basically the natural method movement. And it was
right.
And it's what JFK saw what they were doing. It was body weight. They were doing these obstacle courses, and JFK said like that's the program we need in all of our high schools. And it's fine, but then it died. It went away because people started spending less time on physical education. They want to spend more time preparing for tests and whatnot. But I mean, it's a fascinating, again, it's just this idea that they're taking this ancient ideal. And like the guy who invented, who was leading this program, he went to the Greeks. Like he actually would study Greek philosophy, study the Greek text to figure out what they need to be doing in the gym to create strong people. And yeah, going back to MoveNet, going back to this idea, this heroic idea the Greeks had was you had to be useful. I mean, that's the theme. That's the motto of MoveNet, right? Be strong to be useful.
That's it. You know, but the funny thing is, though, Brett, you got to slow down on your content, man. You guys pump out so much great stuff that I actually had that La Sierra High School page from your website bookmark, but I haven't read it yet. But that's how I know about it from you. I just got to catch up, man. I'm still lost in Jack London right now. Yeah, but that was, you know, and the funny thing about it was, so Georges Hebert's motto was be fit to be useful. And I thought, you know, man, you could actually boil that down to two words. And these two words become the perfect motto for your life, which is just be useful. And when you think about that, if you apply that test to everything you do in your life, you know, be useful. You know, as I'm going out for fast food, am I really being useful? Wouldn't it be better if I actually learned to cook, to prepare a meal and picked up something that's a real food instead of this, you know, bread and sugar concoction? When I go out to exercise, if I'm doing bicep curls, am I really being useful? You know, or maybe I should just climb a rope instead. And again, I love that as a two-word test for every action in your life. Be useful.
And the amazing thing is when you make that your motto, not only are you going to probably have benefits personally, but like on a physical level, but it transforms you like psychologically and emotionally, right?
It doesn't turn you into like Quang Chi Kane, you know, like one of these like abstemious monks. It just is an awareness. And even today, you know, when I eat something, like I just ate four Oreos like about 2 seconds before we went on this podcast. And at least I was mindful. Like, all right, I don't eat these Oreos. My blood sugars are going to spike. I'm going to slump afterwards. But you know what? I feel like having some Oreos. In the past, I would have just eaten the Oreos without blinking. But at least now, if you're aware and you're making decisions, you're doing informed movements. You're not just reacting to impulse.
So we've talked a lot about the physical, you know, the physical feats of this Greek heroic ideal. But you also explore the diet because, you, like you said earlier, these guys were able to go days without food, but they were not just sitting around doing nothing. They were trekking over mountains. So what was it about the diet on Crete that allowed these individuals to do that?
So, you know, one of the first accounts when I was reading this amazing account of George Sikandakis, the Cretan foot messenger, he writes this one story about how he was lost in the mountains for a couple of days delivering these messages. And, you know, there's a death sentence hanging over his head. If he's spotted, he's dead. There's no interrogation. The German force is going to put a bullet in his head and kick his body off a cliff. So he's got to stay off the trails, which often meant just foraging for food on his own. And at one point, he describes being in this little cave, and the only food he could find was some leftover horse feed, you know, some hay. So he takes the hay, and he knew the dried grass in his own state would be toxic. So the only way, the old Cretan shepherd trick was to boil it seven times and then drink the water. So this guy takes the hay, he boils it seven times, and then he drinks the water. Now, if you've ever eaten dry grass, there is zero caloric outtake from dried grass you've boiled seven times. This guy's put nothing in his body except for like Dunkin' Donuts coffee. And so that was my question. How the hell is this guy surviving? And I think the thing was, he was relying on the idea of using fat as fuel. He was able to change his metabolism. So instead of being on a constant sugar cycle that most of us are on, he was on a fat as fuel cycle where he could tap into his own natural body fat, which, you know, at this point in my life, I could probably walk to California from Pennsylvania without a bite of food with, you know, the 18% body fat I've got on my body.
So, yeah, they had a high fat diet. So a lot of goat, a lot of goat meat, goat fat. And it's still like that today. That's how the Cretans are still eating today. And I guess they're one of the healthiest people on the planet.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's all the threads ultimately connect, you know. So you look at what the paleo diet is today and its connection to the Mediterranean diet, which essentially was the Minoan diet. And essentially it's the same diet that Michael Pollan talks about. You know, eat real food, mostly vegetables, not too much. You know, eat a palm-sized chunk of some kind of high-fat food with a bunch of vegetables, and you're good to go. And that's basically the Cretan diet. The Cretans will butcher a goat. They will preserve the meat. They will eat the meat on the fly, and they will forage for what's known as orta. And orta, anywhere you go on Crete today, you will see people walking around like picking weeds and sticking them into those blue plastic shopping bags. That's orta. And orta is just wild greens that are cultivated. And, you know, we did a great thing. There's we did a series on Outside Magazine, Outside Online, where I had this woman from Brooklyn come down to my house and forage with us. And she's Greek by heritage. And Leda, she went out literally like two steps out my back door to something that I just look at as a little bit of lawn. And she said, oh, here, you know, here's mustard greens. You know, here's clover. Here's dandelion. And she was just picking all these calorically dense, phytonutrient-rich foods, literally arm's reach from my back door.
It's amazing. Yeah, and the eating on the fly with the Cretans, I guess part of the reason is that because I remember reading a book about Cretan shepherd life, is that if you stole a goat, like you had to eat it right away to destroy the evidence. Like you had to make a fire and then eat it really fast so no one can know that you stole the goat.
I thought that was kind of,
it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, again, all those things go hand in hand too, because, you know, you don't want the meat to spoil. You don't want to be carrying it around. You want to be quick and loose on the fly. So get the fat in your belly, hide the remains, and be on your way.
Get going. So, Chris, I'm curious, how did writing this book change you? Are you still doing MoveNat parkour? I mean, you ate some Oreos.
Yeah, can we delete that part about the Oreos?
Right.
Give me that part. In a lot of ways. But I'll tell you, Brett, the most important impact was, again, the mindfulness. It's just being aware. When I went through this guy named Phil Maffetone, who essentially took the fat as fuel secret of the ancient Greeks, and he applied it to top Ironman triathletes. Well, he created something called the two-week test. And what I love about Phil is, you know, he's not one of these hardcore in-your-face gurus. He's more of like a 1970s hippie. He's like, hey, man, I'm not going to try and change your mind. You can change your own mind. And the way he does that is instead of telling you what to eat, he says, do the two-week test. And the two-week test means you remove all the high glycemic foods from your diet for 14 days. And on the 15th day, go ahead and have yourself a piece of bread and see how you feel. What I love about it is it strips away all the variables. It gets you back to the basic, you know, factory preload. And then as you add the variables, you can assess how you physically feel. And the beauty of this to me, by the time I was done with Natural Born Heroes, after having learned parkour and MoveNet and doing the two-week test, understanding about my fascia, is that it just made me so much more mindful that everything has a cause and an effect. If I eat the Oreos, I'm going to pay the price for it. If I don't eat the Oreos, I'm going to feel better. If I, for breakfast, for instance, eat a high-fat, almost zero-carb breakfast, I'm going to feel really good to bang out the door for a good two-hour trail run a little while later. If I eat a bunch of oatmeal with honey on top, I'm going to feel sluggish the rest of the morning. Prior to doing Natural Born Heroes, I never really connected those cause and effects. If I felt sluggish, well, I just drank some coffee. I tried to combat it that way. I didn't try and preload by understanding what was causing my body to react in a certain way. Here's another like little example. So recently, I was doing this 50K trail run and started to get a real sort of severe pain in my groin. Now, in the past, I would have assumed, okay, well, you got a pain in the groin. That's the way it goes. You pull the muscle. But then I stopped, analyzed what I was doing, and realized I'm not bouncing anymore. I'm trudging. And even though I was tired, I made the effort of adding that quick, sharp fascia cretin bounce back to my stride. And in a matter of a couple of seconds, you know, the pain, which ordinarily would have caused me to drop out of the race, just disappeared.
That's awesome. Well, Chris, this has been a fascinating conversation. Like, we literally like scratched the surface. There's a lot more we could dig into. So I highly recommend listeners to go out and get your book. But where can people learn more about your book?
We did a really cool series on Outside Online, which looked at, we broke down a bunch of the different skills. I did something on parkour, on foraging for food, on, again, one of the guys we didn't even talk about, that crazy Stoughton warrior, Percy Serity of Australia. So check out Outside Online for the Natural Born Heroes series, and then the book itself. And then anybody wants to ask me questions, honestly, fire away. I got an email address on my website.
Awesome. Chris McDougall, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Brett, I'll do this anytime, man. I had a blast.
My guest today was Christopher McDougall. He's the author of the book Natural Born Heroes. You can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. And really, go pick up a copy. It's a really fun, informative read. And also make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/heroes. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you use to listen to the podcast. Help spread the word. And if you can't give us a review, just recommend us to a friend. I'd really appreciate it. As always, I appreciate the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.